I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source with James Wood, the first reader of fiction at the New Yorker magazine. He speaks of great novels as the nearest thing to life, as art that enters your bloodstream. So we're sidling up and asking him, as you would at an airport, for a syllabus for life, books that can get you through anything. Dostoevsky for Road Rage, Virginia Woolf for Beauty in Life, Teju Cole for A Long Walk in the City, Henry James for the example of unconditional love and forgiveness of his own creatures. So get a pencil and paper. James Wood is actually giving us a list of 10 books that show us ourselves from every angle. Books that meet the Henry James test of art that makes life, makes interest, makes importance, as little else does.
I like that you mentioned the Henry James letter, because that emphasis on making life seems to me an important one. In scholarship, in academic worlds, the word life can be seen as somewhat naive. Academics feel that it needs quotation marks about it, that there's something a little philosophically ingenuous about invoking it. I disagree. I'm constantly living literature, obviously, and also feeling that it connects very easily and seamlessly with life. But I also like the emphasis that James puts in your quote on making life, that you don't just walk down a street with a mirror, as Stendhal described the novelist. I mean, that's our image, but that isn't really what happens. A James figure goes down the street, collects all the sensations, and then goes home and makes life. And I think that's true about the George Eliot quote that I use as the title of this book, that art is the nearest thing to life. It's not the same as life. There's one separation, a crucial separation from it, which is the element of art making, of artifice, what happens on the page.
James, start anywhere you want, and you could go in a thousand directions, but of the books that embody that life.
Well, you know, one of the books I mentioned, I'm just thinking of life-giving properties and then death, is Don Quixote. Because it's a very long book with lots of stories within stories, and probably now its sheer size militates against it being read much. There is a book that you feel never wants to end. There's a book that is actually given life, so much so that when the Spanish philosopher Unamuno writes about Don Quixote, he really writes a book about someone he seems to consider as actually alive. I mean, he just talks about him as if he were a saint who actually was not created by Cervantes, but actually rode across the Castilian plains. And to talk about life, there is a book that usually disappoints most readers at its end, because we don't want Don Quixote to die. We're not convinced by his death. And even Cervantes' farewell to Don Quixote seems somehow half-hearted, as if he didn't really believe it himself, as if he can't actually kill off the life that he's created. So strong is its individual existence. Well, that's a pretty good place to start, because that's where it all begins.
James Wood, imagine you're standing in an airport and people are coming up to you and asking you to recommend a book, to address my doubt, to address my illness, to address my pain, to satisfy my sense of beauty.
Ooh, yeah, that's a very good question. Well, so one book I would always begin and end with, and which I teach every year and that I deeply love and reread every year, is Virginia Woolf's To the Lighthouse, a beautiful book. It instructs us in the beauty of prose, but I think it's also a religious or semi-mystical book about searching for the truth. It's a wonderful book about family, about a successful, if not wildly happy, marriage. And interesting in that regard, because I think, you know, novels traditionally are about, you know, marriages that go wrong in some way. I mean, that's the whole adultery motif. So it's interesting in that regard that it's actually about a marriage that sort of hangs together. It's completely vulnerable, risk-taking, and dares the greatest naivety. Lily, in part 3 of the book, actually thinks what you want every novel to think, which is, what is the meaning of life then? Wolfe writes those words. She isn't afraid to write those words. What's it all about then? What is it for? So that would be one novel. I would always recommend Chekhov's stories because I've always thought that one definition of paradise would be a new Chekhov story to read every day for one's whole life. You know, you get up in the morning and there would be your breakfast, and you know, by the breakfast plate would be,
and for your breakfast, sir,
the Chekhov volume opened up to a new story that you knew nothing about. That would be great.
This is my wheelhouse. Start with one, and I'll hit it back.
Well, what about, since we were talking about novels of adultery, you know, the famous story Lady with a Little Dog, which is, I think, Chekhov's brilliantly brief, elliptical answer to what had become an immensely heavy and somewhat judgmental tradition, which is stories of adultery. You know, this is after Madame Bovary, after Anna Karenina. Along comes Chekhov and says, first of all, you don't need 700 pages. You can do it in seven.
Knausgaard, take note, please.
Right. Secondly, let's get rid of all the judgment. Let's get rid of all the death and people committing suicide and so on. Let's just see what would happen if two people try to make a go of it. And actually, I'll end the story there with them just making a go of it, with the author saying, who knows if they'll succeed? I don't know. Throwing up his hands. And within that beautiful form are the most exquisite things, not least that Chekhov starts writing a story which seems to be about a practiced seducer who picks up a woman in the Crimean resort of Yalta, so that the reader is set for a certain kind of story, okay? And then the story turns unexpectedly after the affair is over, after she goes back to her provincial town and he goes back to Moscow and, you know, continues his life. He can't get this woman out of his head, this unremarkable seeming woman from a small provincial town is everything to him, so that he has to then leave Moscow, go back to the town where she lives and meet her and implore her to be with him. Fabulous. Fabulous, fabulous story.
Can I just say, I like that story. It's not my favorite, but it's, to me, a sort of resolution of a type in Chekhov stories. We're always in a village longing for Moscow, or in Moscow longing for the village, or in a relationship and longing to get out, or on the verge of a relationship and dying to get in, or something. Yeah. The Lady with the Dog is, no, here we are, we're stuck. Right. This is over.
Right.
End of story for the next 40 years. But there are so many of those stories. I'm thinking there's one I adore called The Teacher of Literature, about a young man teaching in a suburban school, and he's getting a taste of sort of high-tone living, horses. The girl is mad for him. He commits to her, and a few months in, he comes home one night, and she's asleep, and he's just upset that she's so happy in her sleep. She seems so contented, and there's a white cat on the bed with her.
Yeah.
And he wants to scream, I've got to get out of here. I've got to live my life.
Yeah.
It's almost like he wants, I got to go to America. I've got to discover Emerson and self-reliance and the world.
Right.
And it ends completely unresolved. You don't know what's going to happen. Although a Russian woman said to me, no, Chris, he stays. That's the Russian ending. Of course he stays. And he lives a miserable life of gray self-sacrifice or something.
Yeah. No, I love that elliptical thing. The Russian formalist critic Shlovsky called this Chekhov's negative endings. Fiction always has a strong element of artifice, of course. Often that element of artifice is what's irritating about fiction, right? It's the tiresome and rather conventional machinery whereby plot winds itself up and people come in and out of rooms and have their affairs and so on and so forth. And nowhere is that machinery stronger and more insistent in a way, generally, than in the last 40 or 50 pages of a novel, where often I think readers feel cheated, actually, that you feel everything's speeding up, it's heading towards its inevitable terminus, you've worked out anyway long before you get to the end what the end was going to be, and there's a sense of plot busyness. Chekhov, being a short story writer, was to some extent exempted from that anyway, but I think it's very wonderful to break form down as strongly as he does, to get effectively rid of it and say, you know, I'm just going to open these stories out into irresolution. They have these ragged endings which literally expire in ellipses often. I mean, he likes his three or four little dots, you know, at the end of a story, just throwing up his hands.
So somebody comes up to you, James, in the airport and says, I want a story that would answer some of those questions, or at least tease me along in it.
Yeah.
Next up. And I got one for you.
Well, I mean, I'd have to recommend The Brothers Karamazov.
Sure.
Yeah, it's...
For which of 83 reasons?
Well, here I'd have to... I'm afraid my poor interlocutor in the airport would be held for some time, because I would have to talk about my childhood a bit. I grew up in a rather somewhat austere and Christian background, and that book had an enormous influence on me. It actually had an influence of the kind that Dostoevsky feared. Dostoevsky wrote to his publisher saying that he, as a good Christian, hoped that it would convert people, but that he feared that he'd made the atheistical case so well that it might do the opposite. And this would really make poor old Dostoevsky turn in his grave. Before I read the entire novel, which wasn't until university, I encountered as a separate book The Legend of the Grand Inquisitor, the bit that I think Dostoevsky rightly feared makes a devastating atheist case. So I would say to the person in the airport who comes up to me and talking about Brothers Karamazov, I would say that one of the reasons it's an important guide, that novel, is that if we're to think about a belief in a providential God, many of us don't, but it's still part of the grammar of our existence and our discourses, even for those who don't believe, we have to think about the whole question of theodicy, that's to say the question of how you justify the existence of such a God in the face of tremendous pain and suffering and
abuse of children,
random death, abuse of children, and so on. So to think about life is to think about pain as well as joy. It's not just to have sensations, it's actually to have ideas about these matters. Philosophical and theological ideas. And I think that novel is the great, among many other things, that novel is the great inquiry into those issues. And I should say, in fairness, the little bit I read as a teenager that had been extracted for propagandistic purposes deliberately left off what Dostoevsky hoped was the great reply to Ivan's atheism, which is almost like a panel of an iconostasis. It's the story of Father Zossima and Father Zossima's sermon and all that wonderful stuff about how we must seek forgiveness even from the birds for what we wreak on humankind.
Speaking of life, can I just throw in a total amateur's observation about Dostoevsky? When I get into a Dostoevsky head, maybe it takes an hour or into one of these books, I literally begin to see microbes, and I begin to see almost neurons in these people. There's something uncanny about life in Dostoevsky. It is an organic thing, infinitely detailed. You just feel you're plunging into the microscopic vitality of life. Wake up. It's all here. It's going on at an incredible rate all over the place.
Yeah.
And inhale it. This is it.
Yeah. I think that's right. I think he understood impotence and he understood pride and humiliation, resentment. More than any other writer, Dostoevsky is a practical help to me in trying to work out what people want from each other. Usually what they want from each other is, alas, power in one form or another. And I think Dostoevsky understood that and understood what the sources of that desire are, that they have to do with tremendous anxieties, weaknesses, an inability to be truly alone. That's to say, what's really striking about Dostoevsky is that his characters are always seeing themselves in relation to other people. How do I see? How do other people see me? How do I seem? What is the performance of myself like? Mm. Once you've read Dostoevsky, the scales do fall from your eyes because you see the enormous amount of performance that goes into the maintenance of daily existence, and that it's a terrible thing to see that, actually.
Which novels or characters do you think of right there?
Well, I'm thinking of, say, of Raskolnikov in Crime and Punishment. I'm thinking of the narrator of Notes from Underground, who in a famous scene in the second half of that book is in a bar room trying to play billiards when he's casually moved out of the way by a cavalry officer who's much larger and more powerful than him. And it's the casualness of the gesture that enrages the man from the underground, the underground man, so that he begins to be obsessed by this cavalry officer, starts stalking him, knows that he will walk Nevsky Prospect every day at a certain time, decides that he will walk in the opposite direction towards him every day on Nevsky Prospect, and when the two of them meet, he will have barged the officer out of the way with his shoulder. Repeatedly, he doesn't do it, and he goes home and says to himself, why is it that it is always I who swerve and not him? A line I often say to myself, if you think about the daily applications of that, think about some moment of road rage, or think about in some moment where you have written an 800-word email to someone, and you get one line back, and you think, what the hell was that about? I mean, it's like, I wrote 800 words in expiation or you know, tending to your wounded ego, and you send me one line back? Why is it always I who swerve and not you? Eventually, he does pluck up the courage to knock shoulders with the officer and sort of barges him out of the way, goes home, is on cloud nine and sings Italian arias, you know, for a day or two, and then returns to his original feeling, of course, of impotence and resentment and weakness.
So we have the Dostoevsky cure for road rage, and that's important.
Yeah.
And now somebody comes up in the airport and says, I want a book that will show me beauty.
Hmm.
Not necessarily unbordered, but thrill me with just the beauty of story, prose, characters.
Hmm. Well, what about For I Love the Blue Flower by Penelope Fitzgerald?
Don't know it.
Ah, it's a great novel. It's a historical novel, and I'm not usually particularly drawn to historical novels, about the German poet and philosopher Novalis, who lived a very short life. He was about 26 when he died, and who was marked from very early on as brilliant genius and so on, a young philosopher, and who also mysteriously fell in love with, almost at first sight it seems, with a 12-year-old girl who he was determined he would marry when she was old enough. The novel is really about that, about the insanity of this contagion that he catches, and is full of fabulously brief and elegant. See, often the chapters are only a page and a half. Everything is superbly controlled and elegant and very deep. She's got a wonderful sense of irony and comedy. And the book is shot through with suffering because even as he, as the girl he meets, even as they have their engagement party, she is suffering from a tumor on her leg and will die, and does indeed die. And then, in short order, Novalis and two or three siblings also die in their 20s. The novel ends with a fabulous, I even have it here actually, a fabulous passage where it's been a very happy family, the Novalis family. They're called the Hardenbergs. Novalis was a pen name. But the book ends like this. At the end of the 1790s, the young Hardenbergs, in their turn, began to go down, almost without protest, with pulmonary tuberculosis. Erasmus, who had insisted that he coughed blood only because he laughed too much, died on Good Friday, 1797. Sidonie lasted until the age of 22. At the beginning of 1801, Fritz, who'd been showing the same symptoms, went back to his parents' house in Weissenfels. As he lay dying, he asked Karl to play the piano for him, When Friedrich Schlegel arrived, Fritz told him that he'd entirely changed his plan for the story of The Blue Flower. He's been writing a novel called The Blue Flower. The Bernhardt, that's Fritz's younger brother, was drowned in the Saale on the 28th of November, 1800. That's pretty much how the book ends, with a sort of report. And to go back to, you know, what I was saying earlier, one has such a strong sense in the book of the boundedness of life, these short lives, actual historical lives that Fitzgerald is writing about, the boundedness of life combined with the irrepressibility of all the existence within those that boundedness. And I think that's why, even as she's writing that report, which is, you know, rather disengaged in a way or cold seeming, she has the line, Erasmus, who had insisted that he coughed blood only because he laughed too much, died on Good Friday, 1797. I love it because even as she's saying, you know, he died of pulmonary tuberculosis, the novelist part of her is saying the life force goes on, and the life force is the bit of Erasmus that brought joy and life, and that was always trying to minimize his illness by saying that he just coughed blood because he was always laughing. It's a very unsentimental book that can bring you to tears. And I've seen it happen with students when I've taught it, actually.
The Blue Flower by Penelope Fitzgerald. News to me, but it goes right on top of the list.
Oh, it's beautiful. Yeah.
I want to get your reaction to it. I mean, when I think of beauty in a novel, I think of all sorts of Henry James, but most especially The Portrait of a Lady, my father's favorite novel, I think my favorite novel.
Yep.
Isabel Archer, American heiress, goes to England to seek her fortune in a way, or seek her destiny, and she's in this incredibly Jamesian, shall we say, English country house with her aunt and her uncle and her cousin, Ralph Touchett, the brilliant, the beautiful, dying man in a way that she wants. But anyway, this is an incredible moment early on when Mrs. Touchett says it's 10 o'clock and young ladies are not to be up with the men who are smoking cigars, and it's time for bed. And Isabel protests, really, but of course she complies, and she says, a little sarcastically, I hope you'll tell me all the rules. And Mrs. Touchett says, so you can break them, I suppose. And she says, no, so as to choose.
Yes.
But that assertion of her kind of all-American, decisive, pre-feminist selfhood, of course she's going to make the wrong choice,
right?
And we know that. The other characters that I just adore, females in Henry James, Millie Teal and Kate Croy in Wings of the Dove. I mean, perfect beauty and generosity in Millie, another sort of apple of James's eye.
Indeed.
And the worm in the apple, Kate, who's trying to seduce her through her own boyfriend so that Millie will die and leave the fortune, which she does.
Yes.
But they're both transformative people. I mean, there's something deeply godlike in Millie's sacrifice. She's terribly ill and she knows she's dying. She knows she's being had in a way, but forgives her enemy in a way. And Kate, who is an incredibly self-seeking little witch in some ways, is also forgiven too by this father god Henry James.
Yeah.
To me, a sort of miraculous story.
Yes. That sense of forgiveness is, I think, one of the things, going way back to my teens, one of the things that most moved me and moves me about fiction. And I think in part for personal reasons that I was growing up in a somewhat unforgiving world. I mean, there was, of course, a lot of official talk about Jesus as a forgiver.
Mm.
But it seemed that too often that was just rhetoric, and that actually what was grinding, which was sad, what was grinding against that was a more evangelical emphasis on sin and correction and therefore punishment, certainly judgment, that forgiveness was hard to come by. And the novel, it seemed to me, storytelling, when it was done right, seemed to me to offer comprehension and forgiveness for all, for every type of person. Partly because the novel seems to say There's nothing new under the sun. Nothing human is alien to me. And every thought can be thought. Every thought is permissible. If you think of those three things, you've got everything you want, really, haven't you? I was very much drawn as a teenager to this idea of the novel Forgiving All, Seeing All. That wonderful thing that King Lear says, he says, none do offend, none, I say. He's got through judgment, you know, and he's seen the other side, which is a dog is obeyed in office, you know, handy dandy, which is the justice, which is the thief. It's incredibly moving.
A contemporary James, or a novelist that I've never heard of until you write about it.
Someone I wrote about a few years ago who I think had not, this was a debut novel in America, a Nigerian-American writer called Teju Cole.
How we love Teju Cole.
That interested me, that book, for lots of reasons. The book was called Open City, and I liked, what did I like about it? I liked its relative formlessness, that the form essentially followed the inquiry, right? It's about someone walking around New York, briefly going to Brussels, coming back to New York, and encountering people. And I generally like quite formless and plotless literature. I thought it was immensely open to many elements of life. Life as it's lived right now, stories of immigration and displacement, history, life as it was lived, you know, walking around New York and feeling that it's a place of built on bones, slaves' bones, Native American bones. And I thought it was also a brilliant use of something I'm quite interested in, which is unreliable first-person narration. Here is someone who rather fancies himself for his high-thinking liberalism, right? He's an educated chap. He's half German, half Nigerian, the narrator. He's an intellectual. He reads lots. Psychiatric resident at a hospital. He praises himself for his hospitality, his openness towards other people's lives, other people's stories. A Haitian shoeshiner, a Liberian refugee in a holding compound in Queens, who turns out actually to be rather less liberal than he thinks himself to be. And we can see that as readers, reading him against himself. And the novel allows us to do that. I thought it was a really impressive book, and it also has at its heart something that I don't think any other contemporary writer has successfully done yet. Only Teju Cole has done it, which is to say, he might not quite agree with my reading here, but there is a scene in the middle of the book where the narrator in Brussels encounters a young Moroccan radical called Farouk, who initially...
The man who's read Edward Said.
Right, who's read Edward Said and Walter Benjamin, and initially seems to the narrator rather like the narrator. That's what they bond over. He's like reading, you know, the similar kind of, how amazing to discover this Moroccan guy, you know, in Brussels who reads the same stuff as I read. And actually, the more they spend time together, the more the liberal narrator, so-called liberal narrator, realizes, actually, this guy isn't very much like me. He's really angry. He ends a long period of discussion and argument saying, you know, I worship the Prophet Muhammad and would quite happily live in the holy cities of Medina or Mecca, which is an awfully long way from the narrator. And the narrator actually ends the scene sort of washing his hands of Farouk and saying, you know what, I go back to New York to my life. He's left in his space. But what it is over, say, 20 pages is a fabulous, very patient, it's almost all dialogue, just patient examination of anger and the roots of anger. The Moroccan's displacement, his disappointment at his treatment in Europe, his treatment by the academy, his dislike of American hegemony, and the swerve towards a religious resolution of that in Islam. It's all there in 20 pages, done more effectively than any other contemporary writer I can think of.
James, so many books come into your mailbox, and you have to read them and make some stab at a judgment before the world knows. What was it about Karl Ove Knausgård that said, wait a sec, cancel the day's appointments, this could be real.
Oh, I can tell you exactly what it was. I was about 10 pages in, moderately interested in the stuff that he says at the beginning. That I think he's talking about, you know, the struggle to write, and I mean, perhaps more than moderately interested as a writer myself with children. So the material was fairly engaging. But then he just stopped. He just stopped the narrative and talks for about a page and a half in philosophical, essayistic form about time, how hard it is to get a sense of time in one's life. And I thought, if he's prepared to take those sorts of risks, I mean, I already knew that the publisher told me that it was six volumes and so on. There was an aura of risk-taking about the whole thing. But I thought, if he's willing to do that with form, just to stop and think on the page, and also think in a way that isn't recognizably, and there's plenty of so-called thinking going on in scholarly work, you know, by professional philosophers, by theorists and critics and so on. But he does a kind of thinking that is certainly full of ideas, but stays very close to, it's non-academic in some appealing way. It's not, I don't know, it feels lived.
I was just going to say.
It feels lived. And indeed, when he talks about literature, he's like that too. He'll say, you know, this is how I was taught to do it in university, and actually this is how I actually do it. And I'm going to tell you how I actually do it. Yes, so there was a moment where I thought, okay, yeah, I was actually literally arrested by it.
Well, you're part of the reason, because you saw it. It's all over every bookstore and everybody's talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, probably like every... I was going to say like every reader, I want a bit less of him now, but I'm not sure I want to see his face staring out from cover after cover.
He's saying from that cover, thank you, James Wood. I thought I had something going here. James Wood, it's a huge pleasure, and we should do this again. I love
indeed
these places that novels take us, and we've barely begun.
Barely begun.
Thank you so much.
Pleasure. Thank you.
James Wood's new book is called The Nearest Thing to Life, adapting a line from George Eliot. You can find a list of the books and the stories we discussed on our website, radioopensource.org. You'll also find right there James Wood in a longer conversation about Karl Ove Knausgård, and many more books worth reading. And while you're up, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. We'll be speaking to Marilyn Robinson, Michael Sandel, and lots of others in the weeks ahead. This podcast was produced and edited by Max Larkin with help from Connor Gillies. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.